Center Church. Very happy to be with you for another week. We continue this week in our series, Exploring the Parables of Jesus. Before we get into the content today, I want to encourage you, if you are not already participating in a Center community, to please do that. During this time, we would ask that you prioritize Center communities because this is an opportunity to pray with one another, to take communion together, to support one another in conversation through edification and by challenging each other. And we found that as these Center communities grow, we find that there really is a need for people to be able to come together and to share their gifts in such a way that we grow each other each week. If you are, as we do have people who listen to this but are not connected with the community, I want to remind you that the most efficient way to do that is to go to 417 Center Church, to go to our website, and to fill out a short form which will allow us to organize you into the right Center community, or at least give you a list that is comparable with when you are free and available to do something like that. Not suggesting you shouldn't text or reach out to people within the community, but that is a certain way to know your needs will be addressed and the communication lines remain open and clear. Well, that's all of the housekeeping we have today. Let's jump into our parable. So we have, at this point, looked at the parable of the Good Samaritan, talked about parables broadly, and then looked at the parable itself. Those were the first 2 weeks of this series. And last week, we looked at the pearl of great price. This week, a parable still yet distinct from the first two. And these parables can be organized thematically into clusters, and that is certainly so. But I've been intrigued by the ways in which each parable seems to be saying something fresh, even though they have so many similar through lines running from one to the other. So today we're going to be looking at the parable of the mustard seed. The resources that I rely on today include Amy Jill Levine's Short Stories by Jesus, as well as Francis Farrar Capon's book on the parables. I mention Levine every time. This is not just to give a plug, but to make sure that we give credit where it is due. That's I think, very important, because she is, in this particular series, such a bedrock of scholarship for my thinking on these parables. As I've mentioned before, not the only one. Various commentators, and additionally Brad Young, and additionally Capon, but she is really our primary sourcing here. And so that's a good place to go if you find this content compelling. Let's take a look at the mustard seed, the parable of the mustard seed, which shows up in three places across the Synoptic Gospels. I'm going to read all of them so that you can notice the similarities and the differences. Let's start with Mark chapter 4, verses 30 through 32. And he said, "How may we depict the kingdom of God, or by what parable may we present it? As a grain of mustard that, when sown upon the soil, is smaller than all the seeds on earth? And when it is sown, it rises up and becomes larger than all the garden herbs, and produces great branches so that the birds of the sky are able to shelter under its shade?" And he spoke the word to them in many such parables, according to what they were able to hear. Let's look at Matthew 13, verses 31 and 32. He set another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of the heavens is like a mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field, which is indeed the smallest of all seeds, But when it grows, it is larger than garden herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the sky come and dwell in its branches. He told them another parable. The kingdom of the heavens is like yeast, which a woman took and mixed into 3 measures of flour until all of it was leavened. We'll discuss these companion parables in our teaching today. And then finally, Luke 13. Luke 13, verses 18 and 19. He said, therefore, what is the kingdom of God like? And to what may I liken it? It is like a grain of mustard, which a man took and cast into his own garden, and it grew and became like a tree. And the birds of the sky took up lodging in its branches. And again he said, to what may I liken the kingdom of God? It is like yeast, which a woman took and hid in 3 measures of flour until the whole was leavened. So we see that there are, even just if you're, I don't presume necessarily reading along, some of you might be, but even if you're listening along, you might pick up on some subtle differences among these depictions of the parable of the mustard seed. So, first, the parable remains very open to interpretation. Not all parables. I have, in passing, critiqued over the last few weeks a tendency to allegorize, to domesticate the parables of Jesus. Those are not the same thing, but we can do that. But it's not because I don't love allegory. In fact, I do. It's simply that we need to be cautious about what we read into the text. We'll read something into it, one way or another, but we should be careful about this so that the parables are able to do what they, at a literary level, are intended to do, which is to provoke. So the parable remains open to interpretation. Well, that's true simply because it's a parable, but it's particularly true because it takes these different forms in the Synoptic Gospels. The changes are minor, in my view, and I think there's consensus on this, well, at least in some cases, but near consensus, that this is probably a result of Jesus simply offering slightly different versions of, you know, his own mind-bending complex teachings. So it's you know, he's not, you know, he is a human. He is a tremendous communicator. He reads his audience, and he's probably telling slightly different versions of these for all kinds of different reasons as he is traveling through Galilee and the Galilean teaching, right? So I think that is, we won't spend much time on their differences. We'll explore some of the possible implications, but it doesn't strike me as likely or necessary that he would tell a parable in the exact same way every time. And that does lead us to the ways in which a parable provokes. I said this primarily in our first discussion on the parables themselves, but I think that a very subjective yet very useful metric for knowing if you are on the right track on these parables is the question, am I being provoked? Is this provocative? Is this challenging? And when the more we get closer, the more we move toward less and less comfortable interpretations, the more we may be onto something, the less likely it is that we're simply reading our own preferences into the text. So this parable is provocative in a way that I think the previous two may not be. While the parable and its meanings are very open, arguably even more so than other parables, I think it's the implications of how we live out this parable that becomes most provocative or challenging in our own lives. So what we're going to do to frame this, I'm going to offer 2 major interpretive approaches from the sources that I'd mentioned prior. And then I'll talk about a strong interpretive approach that doesn't necessarily contradict all that I will talk about in the first two interpretive approaches. But it doesn't affirm it either. And then we'll talk, then I have a few observations by way of essentially like close. The last third will be the observations I have around this parable. So again, we'll look at two major interpretive approaches. I'll talk about the validity of those and the problems with them. Then we'll talk about a strong approach, which brings some pieces of those first two together. And finally, some insights and analysis, which will close our discussion. So the first major interpretive approach is that the driving theme in the parable of the mustard seed is one of contrast. This is all about the contrast of something very small against something very large, and the experience of growth, rapid growth even, or ongoing growth, I should say, from something very small to something very large. The very large thing may be a vegetable or it may be a tree. I think that to obsess over this probably misses the point. The point is that whether or not this is seen as a very large vegetable or even as a bush, as some or a shrub, as some commentators, scholars have suggested, or a tree. The point is that it begins as something minuscule, and its culmination is something entirely other. So the ways of framing this theme are many. There are many ways to think about what this small contrasted against large might be referring to. And they all have their proponents. The first, I would encourage you, as I mentioned now probably every week, to feel free to pause this if you are in discussion and listening. I do know that we have some people who do it that way. But even if you know you're on your own, I think it's valuable to, before hearing other voices, to reckon with the parable yourself. So it's been so valuable. My approach to these parables is to very early in the week start to read the parables I'm considering looking at, and I leave room. It doesn't take very long to read them. I leave room for a lot of time to meditate on them and think through them. But before I look at any commentary, before I look at any scholarship, this is a really valuable exercise and opens up a lot of insights. So before I get into this, feel free to pause and return later. If the primary theme is the contrast between small and large, or the process of something minuscule becoming something large, there are many ways to read this theme, many reference that it could be referring to, pointing to. Very popular one is, and these will not be surprises to you, one interpretive approach is Christological. These are all, by the way, in this first major interpretive approach, these are all overlapping. So this approach of small to large can be understood in the following few ways. One is Christological. Jesus is a first century teacher whose reach in 2020 is astounding. I mean, this was a man who lived in the first century, who lived a short life, who was given a shameful death, and people who are not remotely religious, who are agnostic, who are uninterested in faith systems, spend their time and energy, sometimes their careers, studying this person, thinking about this person. That's really, really interesting. I mean, that this idea that Jesus is in the mustard seed thinking about his own ministry arc is a very interesting idea, and one that's worth some time to process. You know, this is a man who did not write a single word. I mean, as so many ancients and so many famous teachers of that time didn't, but this is a man who did, other than writing in the sand, and we don't know what it is, and that story is contested. I mean, this is someone who, whether you are religious or not, is a point of fascination, and for many, a point of frustration, and that is also a compliment of a kind. This is someone who began very small and who has now expanded the globe over. So there is a Christological reading that I think has merit in this way. There's also this overlapping but different reading in the first major interpretive approach, which is soteriological. That essentially means how we think about or the process of salvation. And this also has proponents. The redemption has a small start. It begins in Christ. It expands through his disciples, through the early church, through suffering. And this small beginning has universal implications, so that within the parable, and now we find ourselves, commentators point us to something quite allegorical. We have the birds of all nations, or all birds of all nations, depending on who you're reading, finding a home, becoming at home in this always growing church. So on this reading, let's take a look at Matthew chapter 17, backing up one verse to Matthew 19. Then his disciples, privately coming to Jesus, said, "Why were we not able to exorcise," referring to a demon? And he says to them, "Because of your little faith, for amen, I tell you, if you possess as much as a mustard seed of faith, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible to you." A very strange passage, which would warrant its own message, frankly. But you see the imagery playing a role. Something small, something little, something as small as a mustard seed, and the necessity of it to grow, to spread the kingdom. This soteriological frame is evident. Let's take a look at Luke 17:6. A similar but different phrasing. "And the Lord said, 'If you have as much faith as a grain of mustard, you might have said to this mulberry tree, "Be uprooted and be planted in the sea," and it would have obeyed you." So we see the role of small contrasted against large, and the effects of this giving to the followers of Jesus, his disciples, the power, the charge, the mission to spread the message of salvation, to do the good work in the world that will grow the kingdom. This is a soteriological reading. There's a Christological reading, which really emphasizes Jesus' work particularly, Jesus and his identity particularly. There's a soteriological reading, which emphasizes all people, ranging from those who have been possessed to the Gentile nations to those who have not even heard the name of Christ, all people finding a home in the church, universal. So you're already beginning to see how these readings, Christological reading, a soteriological reading, there is overlap between them. It also touches on other readings which particularly emphasize the church or particularly emphasize the ultimate destinations of humankind being this heaven or hell. So there's evidence that this might be something about our eternities, and the mustard seed is representative of what we are as humans, and the contrast is the largeness of of what we will be in the new heaven and the new earth. So 1 Corinthians 15 is an interesting text that may offer some support of that interpretive lens. 1 Corinthians 15, beginning at verse 35, "But someone will say, How are the dead raised, and with what kind of body do they come? Ridiculous man, what you sow is not made alive unless it dies. And whatever it is you sow, you are not sowing the body that is going to come into being, but a naked grain, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has willed, and to each one of the seeds a body of its own. Not all flesh is the same flesh, rather, indeed, one that is of human beings, another is flesh of beasts, another is flesh of birds, and another is flesh of fishes, both heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. But the glory of the heavenly is different, while that of the earthly is different again. One glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars, for star differs from star in glory. And it goes on. This amazing passage, which is one that we're even considering, just chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, a potential series on that chapter alone. It's so brilliant and beautiful. But this is evidence of a kind that we have. Of course, we've left, you know, we're not in the words of Jesus here. We're dealing with Paul, so there are issues of hermeneutics, but the idea that there's something about our eternal state as a contrast against our bodily forms now is a potential reading that lives within this first major interpretive approach, where we're thinking about this contrast between the small seed and the large vegetable, or the large or the tree. So these are various angles that all orbit around the first major interpretive approach. I must say, I find this approach very compelling. I think its greatest weakness actually is, in a way, its lack of provocation. What is maybe most weak about this specific or soul reading is that if Jesus says something along the lines of, you begin small, whatever, or it begins small, whatever we might be referring to, and it ends up being large, something small can become something great, right? That kind of idea, I don't know that alone, frankly, is provocative enough. Jesus never ceases to astound his listeners, and I think there's more. It's not that those things aren't a part of this conversation and aren't viable, but I think there's actually more going on than that. Also, one other critique is that there's no real reason to necessarily assume that a Christological reading or a soteriological reading or a reading that focuses on the church or on the ultimate state of human beings, there's no necessary reason to assume that that is the case. It, in some ways, it lacks textual evidence. Again, these parables are open, but we don't have many clues that point us this way. Let's talk about the second major interpretive approach. There's the first, that this is all about contrast. Here's the second major interpretive approach. The second theme is more interested in the details of the imagery used as opposed to the contrast itself. So the symbolism of the mustard seed becomes important. The symbolism of the tree or the large vegetable or the shrub becomes important. The symbolism of the birds and branches becomes very important, and where else these kinds of images appear in the Bible. And this is also worth a close look, but I think actually comes closer to an incorrect reading than does the first major interpretive approach. This is my view. I think more is read into the parable in a way that might anachronistically overlay our value systems and our concerns onto a parable that is, I think, otherwise more provocative. I must say, though, I find the first interpretive approach very compelling, but if I were just wishing for things to be true, I would happily take the meanings of the second major interpretive approach. I just don't know that I see it happening in the text. Doesn't mean that you don't, but I'm not sure it's there. So let's take a quick look. It would be a very long talk if I covered all of the relevant literature pertaining to this, so I unfortunately won't be able to do that, but I can at least start the conversation, and if you want to dive more deeply into these potential readings, you can. So one position that you'll find in much scholarship is the idea that the mustard seed is despised. It's a rejected weed. I don't remember when I first came across this. It was many years ago, and I'm certain probably in some context I have taught this as true. But really, this lacks, there's some, potentially some evidence that you could construe to think of the mustard seed in this way. But there's really not good primary evidence that the mustard seed is seen as something that is somehow despised or rejected. And I can't remember the first scholar that I encountered that suggested this. I think I know who it is, but I won't say if it's not correct. But it's just it just preaches so well, right? I mean, the idea that this is it, the mustard seed. You always thought of, you heard about it a certain way when you were in Sunday school, but I am here to tell you that in the ancient world, broad statement, no citation, in the ancient world, they viewed the mustard seed as a noxious weed that would take over the whole garden. And do you see how provocative that is? Kind of message. This is a powerful weed that is deadly to our current political religious establishment. It's really an anti-establishment reading of this parable. It's taking over the whole thing. And it's slow. Maybe it grows quickly, but the death of the current kingdom is a slow death. But it's a beautiful thing as God's ultimate kingdom rule takes over. You could see why, because this is hitting notes that really Christians actually affirm, which is to say that the current kingdom is not going to last, which is to say that the systems of injustice that are in place, Jesus is actively working against as he's promoting the kingdom of God. Which is to say that as Jesus, we'll talk about this more soon enough, which is to say that as Jesus is carrying his cross, Jesus takes on at once his cross, but also in his entire life, Jesus is taking on the burdens of the world, the problems of the world that are at once earthly and also spiritual, that are at once political, but are also deeply personal. And there's this idea that only the God-man can endure this suffering and then show us how to endure our own suffering, and that this is an act that subverts. By the way, all that I just said, I believe, is true. I think that is all true. I don't know that that's being said in the parable of the mustard seed, and I don't know that it's a fair reading or correct reading to see the word mustard seed and interpret it through that lens. You will find scholars who do, but the primary problem with this is that the mustard seed, by the way, which is seen as this challenge to perhaps Jewish purity laws and therefore a challenge to our current religious system, and in the ancient world, a current, political and religious system. The primary problem with this is that it doesn't make any sense when we pair the parable with the parable of the leaven. These are profoundly similar. They're meant to be understood as companion parables, and the leaven is in no way about purity. And if the leaven is not about purity, and it certainly isn't, the mustard seed can't be about purity either. It also is worth noting that the idea that the mustard seed was considered to be this vile weed doesn't have support. The mustard seed, Levine notes this directly. She says mustard was a valued medicinal plant. I mean, this is a useful plant, and again, I could delve into the back and forth on that literature, but I'm quite convinced that to read that into the mustard seed, that the mustard seed, the image of it itself, would somehow be a challenge to current establishments. I don't think that's a correct reading. Levine compares it to if you were to modernize the parable, she compared it to saying something like, the kingdom of heaven is like dandelion spores, and expecting people to be put off by this, scared by it, concerned about it. I mean, that those grow quite quickly and rapidly across a yard. I don't think that's keeping us up at night. So it's not, it's, I don't think it has the necessary support, even though there are truths that that some who interpret it that way attempt to bring to the forefront. To deal with one more image in this second large interpretive method or approach is the birds on branches. These birds, in this reading, the imagery of the birds should be seen as destructive or dangerous for cultivated fields. Okay, so now you have the mustard seed that is planted. It grows into this large vegetable or grows into a tree, and the birds come in, and they now have a place to live. And because they have a place to live, they're looking down upon the field, and they have food to eat, and they're going to destroy the cultivated fields. And here, the cultivated fields represent those who have power, represent the current systems that are in place, and the birds on the branches represent those who are disenfranchised, those who are not a part of the kingdoms of power in the world, who are going to disrupt and undermine the whole thing. Because of the mustard, the birds have a place to rule. Very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff. But I don't see the support in this parable anyway. And of course, then you get into other conversations, which are for some very interesting, and others the most boring kind of conversation, which, you know, these tropes of, well, the mustard seed isn't, you do know, you know, says like the random like 17-year-old or something that's trying to disprove, you do know that the mustard seed isn't the smallest seed after all, and then an equally immature or, just ridiculous fashion. Well, Jesus wasn't referring to the mustard seed as the smallest seed in all the world. Rather, he's talking about in the region, or one of the smaller seeds, and you get into like all of these absurdities which have no literary awareness or depth, and that is quite exhausting. Run from those conversations when you stumble across them. But it does bring up is the Bible botanically true? Which is the question we're all asking. Surely one of you is working on a book there. So there are two interpretive approaches for you. The first major approach is about contrast. The second major approach relies on the imagery used in the parable, and it's more to do with the subversion or overthrow of current unjust systems. From those two approaches, I find my sympathies lie more with the first approach, even though the values of both are fascinating, and I think you'll find those in the scriptures. So let's talk about a strong interpretive approach. I'll offer a few observations, and then we'll close. So this is Levine, not a direct quote, but her sentiment. A seed is a seed. A bird is a bird. And a tree is a tree. Sometimes a seed is a seed, a bird is a bird, and a tree is a tree. It may not always mean, an evil kingdom. That a parable is challenging should not be an issue, she says. The issues are better framed in terms of what the parable challenges and how it does so. That's very good, and it's worth restating the last line of her quote. The issue... the whole thing, that a parable is challenging should not be an issue. The issues are better framed in terms of what the parable challenges and how it does so. Yes, we want to challenge unjust systems. Yes, we want to think about the brilliance and beauty of the contrast between our bodies that are earthly and the physical bodies that we'll inhabit in the new heavens and the new earth. Of course, all of that's interesting. And it's and the Christological reading, soteriological reading, all of it interesting. But it's not that it, and all of them challenging, but the issue is more about what is being challenged particularly here. So, very quickly, Mark puts the parable with the seed that grows secretly. So Mark pairs this parable with the seed that is growing secretly, invisibly. No one is aware of this. Matthew gives the detail that the seed becomes a vegetable and then becomes a tree. We're dealing with, to the first interpretive frame, we're dealing with a tremendous contrast here, almost an otherworldly contrast, a minuscule seed, then to a large vegetable, then even to a tree. Luke skips the vegetable step, and the seed becomes a tree. So as we are laying the groundwork for a stronger interpretive approach, I want to go back to Matthew 13, verse 31, and compare, a very quick comparison, which I think will help set the stage, between the parable of the mustard seed and the parable of the yeast, okay? So verse 31, he said another parable before them, saying, "The kingdom of the heavens is like mustard seed that a man took and sowed in his field, which is indeed the smallest of all seeds. But when it grows, it is larger than garden herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the sky come and dwell in its branches." He told them another parable. "The kingdom of the heavens is like yeast, which a woman took and mixed into 3 measures of flour until all of it was leavened." So back to the yeast and seed for a moment. First, they're both small. They both move secretly. They both are invisible, unseen. The yeast in bread, the seed in soil. Both have a utilitarian value, which is a thread we'll come back to in a moment. And both reflect the ways in which, both of these parables reflect the ways in which a single person's action can affect many. Many are able to eat the bread made by the woman. Many are able to enjoy the mustard that comes from the vegetable or the tree. So one person's actions extend to affect many. The comparison of these companion parables, I think, is essential to a strong interpretive approach of the parable of the mustard seed, which is what I want to spend our final portion of time looking at. So here is an approach that I find most useful, most provocative, most challenging. I have, I think, something like 4 observations that will serve as a framework for the parable. First, the invitation is universal. The woman makes more than enough for herself. The mustard plant is more than enough for anyone who would like to use it. This invitation, whatever the kingdom of God is like, whatever the kingdom of the heavens is like, the invitation is one that is universal. I've been revisiting this as of late, and I've been quite troubled, actually, by the ways in which our desire to set the world right, or to see the world set right at a societal level, at a moral and ethical level, might be hijacked by an incomplete gospel. So I want to dial into this for a moment, because if you've been a part of Center for a while and you hear something like this statement, the invitation is universal, it might be easy to begin to take that, the challenge and the provocation of that, for granted, but it should not be taken for granted. And I think now more than ever, our current moment more than ever will challenge us to accept the radicalness of the universality of the invitation of all of the birds to come and live in the branches of the tree. So this is, I'll elaborate on my thinking on this, but this is and why I think that we risk mishandling the building of the kingdom when we unevenly pursue justice at a societal level. I've relied for many years on Wolf, Miroslav Wolf, who wrote one of my, I think for me, one of the more impactful books I've read in my life, Exclusion and Embrace. I probably quoted this exact quote before. If you take the time to read Exclusion and Embrace, you'll find it's one of those books where every passage is underlined. Here's Wolf. "Forgiveness flounders because I exclude the enemy from the community of humans, even as I exclude myself from the community of sinners. But no one can be in the presence of the God of the crucified Messiah for long without overcoming this double exclusion. Without transposing the enemy from the sphere of the monstrous into the sphere of shared humanity, and herself from the sphere of the proud innocence into the sphere of common sinfulness, when one knows, as the cross demonstrates, that the torturer will not eternally triumph over the victim, one is free to rediscover that person's humanity and imitate God's love for him. And when one knows, as the cross demonstrates, that God's love is greater than all sin, one is free to see oneself in the light of God's justice and so rediscover one's own sinfulness. That an entire message could be orchestrated around that long quote from Wolf, but it is absolutely an essential component of one truth in the parable of the mustard seed, which is that the invitation is universal. And yes, that includes, the invitation is extended to those we most despise, to those who are the worst perpetrators of injustice. This is why. This is one of the reasons why. I mean, we shouldn't forget one of Christopher Hitchens, a famous atheist. One of his primary critiques of the Christian project was that it did not bring the sort of justice he believed, he felt, that some portion of humanity deserves. There is a radicalness, and I'm always careful to use that word, this overused word, but it's appropriate here. There's this shocking nature to the universality of the invitation. But Hitchens didn't seem to understand what Wolf does here. Why does forgiveness flounder? It flounders, according to Wolf, because I exclude the enemy from the community of humans and because I exclude myself from the community of sinners. Well, if you include yourself in the community of sinners and you take that seriously, right? So this is to say that you're not just saying some words, but you actually meditate upon the ways in which you are fallen, the ways in which you have dehumanized yourself and others. If you meditate on that, it is so overwhelming and debilitating that you will, even when you do little bits of good for other people, it will come from such a broken and devastated place that if you really take that seriously, it will shut down. It will shut your life down. It really is overwhelming. And it's the same kind of, and we're overwhelmed in the same way when we exclude the enemy from the community of humanity. That is also overwhelming. That also ultimately leads to a reduction, not just a reduction, but like this path to not the other person becoming subhuman, but becoming subhuman ourselves. Wolf, though, brilliantly says it is through the crucified Messiah. It is through understanding that the crucified Messiah eternally triumphs that we can see humanity in others without being overwhelmed with rage and a sense of injustice. And we can see the sinfulness of ourselves without being overwhelmed with despair. Do you see the boldness of a universal invitation? It has to provoke. The second point, we are all invited to become people who would be unrecognizable to our current selves. We are all invited to become people who would be unrecognizable to our current selves. The contrast between small and large, to go back to the first popular frame, I don't think it's on its own. It's not provocative enough. It's useful. It's not untrue. It's just simply not. It doesn't go as far as the parable goes. However, the transformative nature of the movement from minuscule to large certainly is quite provocative. And one of the reasons this is so provocative, and I'm discovering this maybe for the first time. I don't know if I've ever thought of the parables in quite this way. But one of the reasons it is so provocative is that it is once again we have something descriptive happening in this parable, and therefore, by the way, more likely reading. Lewis talks about this. He says that we're all essentially picking up steam in one direction or another. So to say this again, observation number two, we are all invited to become people who would be unrecognizable to our current selves. Notice this does not imply that we will be unrecognizably better. We'll be so transformed, so beautiful, so lovely that who you are now is small by comparison to who you will be. It may be that we will be unrecognizable and it will be beautiful, but it may be that we will be one of us to the other. It may be that we will be unrecognizable and it will be monstrous. I don't know. I don't know what Lewis's best book is. I'm a fan of the Space Trilogy myself, but up near the top of the list has to be The Great Divorce. Here's Lewis. "Son," he said, "ye cannot in your present state understand eternity. That is what mortals misunderstand. They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it." Now, hesitate to interrupt the quote, but not so much that I didn't. No future bliss can make up for it. Have we not all said this ourselves when suffering is so profound, so personal, that we, at this visceral level, feel this, sense this, that nothing ultimately good can make up for this moment of suffering, this year of suffering. Lewis goes on. "They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. And of some sinful pleasure, they say, let me have but this, and I'll take the consequences. Little dreaming how damnation will spread back and back into their past and contaminate the pleasure of the sin. Both processes begin even before death. The good man's past begins to change so that his forgiven sins and remembered sorrows take on the quality of heaven. The bad man's past already conforms to his badness and is filled only with dreariness. And that is why the blessed will say, we have never lived anywhere except in heaven, and the lost, we were always in hell, and both will speak truly." Much, much happening in that quote from Lewis. But do you see its connection to the parable and its challenge? We are all invited to become people who will be unrecognizable to our current selves. The mustard seed, whether it becomes some strange large vegetable or a tree, strikes me as a detail. It's the fact that something invisible and small at once then becomes something entirely other. This really does connect to the 1 Corinthians 15 passage, but it's unfortunately darker than that. It's more descriptive than that. It may be, as we examine our lives closely, that there are certain things pulling us, calling us into something that we would want to be, that we would not want to recognize as ourselves. Our changes are so subtle, so invisible, truly like the seed, that if we reflect on where we were 3 years ago across different metrics, across like different spheres or dimensions of our life, in some ways we will find that we are unrecognizable. And some of you, as you're thinking about some of these deep and almost invisible changes, as you meditate on them, you might say to yourself, oh my word, like this has been beautiful. I am becoming something, like where I am now in these ways is so much richer than where I was. But because the parable provokes, it seems almost impossible that we will not also identify things that concern us deeply. The first point, the invitation is universal. The second point, we are all invited to become people who would be unrecognizable to our current selves. There's something hopeful there, and there's also something descriptive. There's a warning there. The third point, we can survive this too. I have to credit Levine for this observation. It really is directly from her analysis. She doesn't rush past the fact that maybe a bird is a bird, a tree is a tree, a mustard seed is a mustard seed. And she it's almost comical the way she frames it, but these birds are, they are survivors. They're pretty scrappy. The way the parable reads, it feels like the mustard tree, it feels like it springs up overnight. Of course it doesn't, but the bird's not terribly interested in that. They see a potential habitat and they go for it. We have this large tree, and of course, you know, overnight it's filled with life. And whether it's a bird or a human, God creates things that survive. God creates things that, even through suffering, stick with it and are resilient and don't stop. And they're looking for resources, and we're looking for resources, and we make a thing work. And we don't love our circumstances. Not only do we not always love our circumstances, we often don't love our circumstances, but God has made us to be formed by the suffering that shows up in our lives and has made us to survive it. And yeah, we can survive this too, whatever this is. I was visiting with someone this week who was, in a way that was not remotely self-pitying, chronicling their kind of what they had to deal with over this last year, and it was one blow after another that took place across one's physical health, across one's financial situation, one's professional life, just hit after hit after hit. And so, and as you're hearing this, some of you are like, yeah, that's been my year as well. Or some of you are like, actually, best, one of the better years I've had, minus the obvious. But the reality is, you can survive this too. Whatever this is, you are made to survive this. But it's actually more interesting and better than that, because in fact, we really should take the suffering that has been presented to us. We should take it in, and we should allow it to shape us. You know, it's you have to be a fool. You have to be a fool to want suffering. And I've known people, and I bet you have too, I've known people that it seems their whole life is this attempt to avoid suffering. And there's something really quite pathetic about that. And I've also known people, I'm sure you have also known people like this, who by good luck or something, good fortune, have made it into adulthood, well into adulthood, and have not known much much real suffering. And there is, how else shall we say it? I believe that God knows no evil. He knows nothing of evil. He's fully distant, fully removed from suffering. But I do, and we could get into, I mean, there's much to say about that, of course, but we could get into that. But I don't put any evil at the feet of God. God is totally light. He is fully light, fully love. He is life. God is not a God of suffering or evil or sin. But I do believe that God orchestrates, organizes something like that. He takes these sufferings and allows them to shape us. These birds are survivors, and you are too. Thomas A. Kempis, one of the first books of theology I was ever given, maybe in my early teens, was Imitation of Christ. Kempis was a monk, and he was, and so his perspectives are often oriented around meditative practices and silence, and a focus on suffering and pain as a mechanism for sharing in a cruciform life. And I'm going to give you three brief quotes. I actually will not elaborate on them. I just want to offer them to you. And this is something you can do as a community. It's something you can do on your own. But I want to offer you three insights, quotes from Akempis that from The Imitation of Christ. My hope would be that these would serve as meditative tools and would encourage you. Here's Akempis. First, love to be unknown and esteemed as nothing. Love to be unknown and esteemed as nothing. Second, come now and begin this very moment and say to yourself, now is the time to do it. Now is the right time to amend my life. Finally, Jesus has always many who love his heavenly kingdom, but few who bear his cross. He has many who desire consolation, but few who care for trial. He finds many to share his table, but few to take part in his fasting. All desire to be happy with him. Few wish to suffer anything for him. You can survive this too. The suffering that comes into your life, trust that God is organizing it. See the cruciform nature of it. And my hope and prayer is that it shapes you. The fourth and final observation I actually believe may be the most challenging and also perhaps will provoke the most conversation. It's certainly provocative. It's certainly built into the parable. So here we are, final observation. Take on the burden of others. This is part of the cruciform life, the imitation. Take on the burden of others and step out of the spotlight as much as possible, because this is a domestic act of service. Okay? So, again, take on the burden of others and step out of the spotlight as much as possible. This is a domestic act of service. So I'll tie this together, but you'll have to stick with me for a final few minutes. So I want to talk about some ways that this parable could be badly abused in a culture that it's horrifying in the way that it melds together, it blends together the good news of Jesus and some awful picture of the American dream. So let's talk about some counterfeits. The small to large metamorphosis, of course, has no necessary correlation with wealth and notoriety. And I know our community well, and I know that none of you were thinking that. And not even like not saying it, you weren't thinking that. You're bothered when people try to turn the gospel into some mechanism for profiteering. Now, within American culture, there are some subcultures which they would say, yes, reject a prosperity gospel. But no, this parable certainly could be about something like measurable impact. And really, this is a kind of Christianese for saying, no, it's not about money, but it might be about, you know, how many people are attending my service, or it might be about how many people liked, how many times I was retweeted, how many people liked my post, how many positive responses I received to the thing that I did, the work that I did. And we are okay. We're okay sitting in the spotlight if we feel we're making positive impact. But the parable challenges us more than that. It is a domestic parable. I'll talk about that in a moment, but it's a domestic parable. Yes, it says do good. Yes, it says carry on, take on the burden of others in all of the ways that we are attempting to do, but it leaves no room for being in the spotlight. And this becomes even more challenging than that in the following way. This parable, of course, cannot be all about the things we might associate with small to great. In other words, it's not just anything that we see that goes from something that is small to something that is great. It's talking about the kingdom. And this is curious. If you heard a reading of this parable, again, where somebody suggested this is their path to riches, starting small, winning the world, you would pity the person, you might see it as laughable. However, in many ways, we may be coming from the exact same place when our ambitions and our goals are grandiose, are attention-grabbing, insist that we stand alone in the spotlight, or we are one among several in the spotlight. There's a hubris in that. There's a hubris in a desire to do something big, to make some kind of big impact, instead of focusing on the small, the invisible, the domestic. These are small images. The mustard seed is small. These are nameless people. A man who throws the seed, baking bread, casting seed, doing good, almost trying to remain invisible in the good work that is done. I think there's something incredibly freeing in that. Avoid the spotlight. Seek to work in private. Seek to do good so that no one sees. It will keep us humble and it will keep us on the right trajectory so that the thing we're transformed into is in Christ's likeness. Do the good thing and leave it alone. And Levine says, and we're ending with this quote, she talks about the domestic nature of this parable, which in a way is, I think, one of its most challenging features. She says this, first, some things need to be left alone. Keep fiddling with the dough and it will not rise. Keep exposing the seed to air and it will not germinate. Not everything or even everyone needs our constant attention. Also, sometimes we need to get out of the way. We are not always the focus. Sometimes we are the facilitator for something bigger than ourselves. The woman hides the yeast in the dough. Whether people knew she did the baking or not remains unstated. The man plants or even tosses the seed. Who sowed it is much less important than the tree into which the seed grows. The challenge of the parable could be much homier. Don't ask when the kingdom comes or where it is. The when is in its own good time. As long as it takes for seed to sprout and dough to rise, the where is that it is already present in the world. The kingdom is present when humanity and nature work together and we do what we are put here to do, to go out on a limb to provide for others and ourselves as well. Center Church, as always, so appreciate you, and I look forward to visiting with you again next week.